So we designed a plan where we could, other than Garrett, now the Garrett Aerospace Division had superb engineers and superb in the signal part of the company, but the Wheelabrator people didn't really have much. So we designed a program and went to Dingman and said, look, this laboratory can do not only work for the UOP Process Division, but we can do things for your other divisions that will make you more competitive in those businesses as well, without you having to build laboratory facilities in each and every one of those other divisions. Well, we sold that, and they changed the name to the Signal Research Center. And so at that point, we were able to branch out. And to be honest, that branching out was helpful not only to those other companies, but frankly to UOP as well, because it opened them up to some material science kind of problems, things like that, that probably they would not have looked at had it not been for that thing. So that worked out, and we were back doing reasonably well in 1985, when the whole thing fell out because we were essentially bought out by the Allied Corporation. Hennessy, Ed Hennessy, who was the CEO at the Allied Corporation, was very much interested in particularly the Garrett part of the company, because he was the person who had acted as the White Knight in the Martin Marietta Bendix fight and had bought out Bendix. And he owned the Bendix automotive sector, and he owned the Bendix aerospace sector. And the Garrett engine division, Garrett had both the engine division and their, what they called their equipment division, which made air conditioning units and things like that for airplanes. And the combination of the Bendix aerospace plus the Garrett aerospace really made a very nice match and made a very good aerospace company. And so they merged the Allied Signal. That was 1985 when the merger happened. And I will always remember that because a few of us were in China when that merger happened, in the process of talking to the Chinese about increasing our presence in their petrochemical and refining development in China, when the announcement was made, and all of us had to come home very quickly. And then after the merger, it turned out that we had some people from the chemical sectors in the old Allied Chemical who really understood the value of the UOP laboratory and the pilot plants. And so the engineered material sector, which was the old chemical sector of Allied, UOP went with that sector. We became part of that. And so the laboratory at UOP became the laboratory for the engineered material sector of Allied Signal. And we combined. They had a small corporate laboratory in Morristown, New Jersey, at the Allied Corporation's headquarters, which is where the headquarters then came for Allied Signal. The laboratory then began to serve not only UOP, but a bunch of those chemical companies as well, the fibers division, the plastics division, what have you. And then in 19, and that worked very nicely. We had some things going that really I thought worked out very well. And it was beneficial, again, to both sides, because UOP was able to see some things which they'd not seen before, and clearly we were a help in the pilot plant division for the chemical businesses. But then in 1988, the fellow who had been the president of the engineered materials sector at Allied Signal, whom I reported to, became president of Allied Signal, Inc. And at that time, two things happened. One was they made the decision to joint venture UOP with the molecular sieve division from Carbide. We had tried back in the early 80s to buy the molecular sieve division from Carbide, because one of the things that UOP had not done, they had missed the window on zeolite development for catalysts. And now they still used them, but they'd missed the window to really be a big player in that. And so they tried to buy the molecular sieve division from Carbide in the early 80s. Carbide wouldn't sell. We tried again after the Allied Signal merger, and they still wouldn't sell. But in 1988, when all of this business, and Carbide ran into some big problems, you remember, they came back and said, look, we won't sell, but we would consider a joint venture. So they put UOP and the molecular sieve division together in a joint venture, which is now UOP. What the UOP of today is the merger between, is the joint venture between Carbide and it's a 50-50 jointly held joint venture. Probably one of the most successful of those that I know. Those things, you know, have been done around the industry. Some have worked, most have not. This one worked very well because it was really appropriate. I mean, they do have major synergisms, because UOP has all of the knowledge about how to apply their zeolites, and the molecular sieve division for Carbide, as you know, is probably the biggest generator of new zeolitic materials ever. So that has worked out really quite well. So they put that joint venture together, and at the same time, Alan Belzer, who had been the chief executive for the engineered material sector, went up to become president of Allied Signal Inc., and he wanted me to come and become the chief technology officer for the company as a whole and manage the corporate laboratories rather than just the UOP ones. And what happened was we split the laboratories in Des Plaines. We gave a big chunk of them to the joint venture, because you had to separate it out, and we kept a small segment of Allied Signal people there who were working on the other Allied Signal things. And so we had that, plus we had the laboratories in Morristown, which were the corporate Allied, the old Allied Chemical corporate laboratories, plus Allied had kept a laboratory in Buffalo, New York, and that was part of the corporate laboratories as well. And we put those all together as part of the corporate research labs of Allied Signal, and I came then in 1988 as the chief technology officer, senior vice president for technology for Allied Signal.
In this merger, changing identity of parent company, was there any disruption of the scientific personnel with which you were associated?
Clearly, there's always some. For example, after the Wheelabrator merger, we were forced to reduce staff, and we managed to do that in ways that did not hurt the long-term viability, but that's always tough to do. But what we decided to do was that since we had to do it, that since we, in the industry, you can take out people as you wish, we decided to truly take out the lowest performers and the people who were at the fringes. And by doing that, that helped the morale a lot, because, you know, some people had not been pulling their weight all that much anyway, and so people who've been working hard kind of appreciate you noticing who's doing what. So we managed to survive that okay. Then after the Allied Signal merger, because of the fact that we could pool our resources with the old Allied Chemical group and make that work, our reduction, and by the way, after that reduction in staff, we built back up fairly quickly, as it turned out. And then after that merger, though, with Allied Signal, we had to sort of regroup, if you will. But that wasn't so bad, because we had things to offer that the Allied Chemical people really wanted. And so that was not such a disruption. In fact, we managed that one, I thought, with pretty good, in a pretty decent way. When the UOP merger, I mean the UOP joint venture was put together, that was really pretty traumatic, because this meant dividing up some people who had worked for UOP forever. And some went with the Allied, stayed with Allied Signal, and some went with the joint venture. But I think we handled that in a way that most people didn't feel too badly, but you always had some people who were concerned about that. There's always some trauma associated with it.
I believe I read that one of the achievements at UOP during your time there was in very successful anti-fouling agents for ocean-going vessels. Is that?
No, that was some of my old UOP research.
Okay.
We never translated that into stuff at Allied. No.
Okay.
We looked at it one time, but we decided because of all these environmental issues that were associated with it, it probably was not something we should be doing.
I would like to back up a bit now before we go on to your later and current employment opportunities, to take a look at your service to the profession and your roles in American Chemical Society governance. Could you give me a synopsis view of activity?
That's interesting. I was fairly active in the local section in Baton Rouge when I first came there because it was it's kind of a way to meet people and that sort of thing, and I kind of enjoyed it anyway. And then when I went down to New Orleans, there was a fairly active chapter in New Orleans. And again, it was sort of at that time there was really kind of a really vital chemical group there. And you had some companies that participated as well. You had the old Freeport Sulfur Company that was there. Shell Oil had some people there in those days. There was a fair amount of industry activity as well as the university activity. So the New Orleans section of the ACS was a pretty vital group of folks, and so that went very well. And I just enjoyed it for lots of reasons. And I always thought it was really good to get your students involved because they need to get some professional as well as some technical training if you can. And, you know, we used it for student programs and all kinds of things. And then in 1972, I had been on a couple of national committees, and I guess the first real attention I got in the ACS, I was chairman of the Meetings and Expositions Committee of the ACS. I don't even remember how I got there, but anyway. And we met in Miami Beach. I don't remember whether you went to that meeting or not, but that was one of the worst meetings the ACS has ever put on. Housing was atrocious. I was active in the inorganic division, and I was asked to go and make a presentation to the Meetings and Expositions Committee about how badly this thing had been handled. So I thought, well, all right. So I went, and we just had people, we just had people that didn't get their rooms, they couldn't get, it was just a disaster. So we made a major presentation to them, and apparently that came to the attention of people. And so what happened, I got appointed to the committee. You know, it's what usually happens, you should keep your mouth shut. But anyway, then in 1972, Hap Fisher, who was the director of the Regional Agriculture Laboratory in New Orleans, which, by the way, was another reason why that whole section was really pretty active, because in those days, that was a really good lab. That's the old ag lab there, Regional Agriculture Laboratory. And Hap Fisher was the director of the Regional Laboratory, the New Orleans Regional Laboratory for the Department of Agriculture. And he was running for the board of directors from that. You remember how the ACS has regions. And that region, he was running for the board from that region. And the Nominations and Elections Committee called me up, and we put a lot of effort into getting him on the ballot. So the Nominations and Elections Committee called me up and wanted me to run for the board. And I said, I can't do that because I've actually worked to get half on the ballot. Whatever, I can't do that. And they called back and they said, no, we really would like for you to run because we'd like to have, and they, you know, they always do try to put two good candidates on the ballot. And I said, well, I'll think about it. So I went over to see Hap Fisher, and I said, Hap, what should I do? I said, you know, we've worked very hard to get you on this ballot and all that kind of stuff. And he said, well, you don't have any choice but to run. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, they have never asked a woman to run before. And he said, you don't really have a choice. And I said, well, if you think that way, I said, I'll do it. And I said, but I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to campaign. I'm not going to do anything. He said, fine, neither will I. So that's how come. And to this day, I don't know how I got elected. I think part of it was I had been the program chairman for the last joint Southeast-Southwest meeting in 1970. And so a lot of people in the region knew me from that, and I suspect it was because of that. So that was my introduction to ACS governance, and I was elected to the board in 1972. And I was put on the publications committee. Bryce Crawford was chairman of the publications committee, and I got to know him very, very well through the years. And he's just a wonderful person. So I stayed on the board for, I guess, three terms. And was elected, I was elected chairman of the board in 1978. That was back in the days of all of that nonsense about the grassroots group, if you remember. And we had all those people that were trying to dismantle the ACS because they thought the governance was unfair and undemocratic and all that. So there was major battles in the board itself, politically, as to where these things went, and then I was reelected in 1980. When I moved to Chicago, I guess my last term on the board as chairman, anyway, was in 1980. I was asked to run for the presidency, but that was the year that I was appointed to the National Science Board. And I was going to this new job, and I just couldn't see that I could do both of those. So I withdrew from the ACS presidential race. That was the year that Bob Perry won. And everybody thought that I withdrew because of the three-way candidacy. So it would leave Bob a clear view to win, but that really was not the case. I really did withdraw because I couldn't see how I could do both that and the... And be a new member of the National Science Board. And then, of course, I came back and ran for president in 1980. In fact, I agreed to run in 1986 for president. I won, and had I known that I was fixing to move to Morristown as the senior vice president for technology, no way would I have done that. Because it was just, it was really more than you really should have taken on at the time. But
you seem to manage to do both.
Well, yes, we did. But like I say, had I known that was going to happen, I would not have. But you're stuck. I mean, you're already there. You've got to do it the best you can. And the Allied people were very supportive, I must admit, as well. So we had help, and it wasn't all that difficult.
Unlike a lot of the presidents of the American Chemical Society, you had experience... being chairman of the board,
right,
as well as president of the society. Did you find those executive positions satisfying?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I really enjoyed being chairman of the board. In fact, being chairman of the board of the American Chemical Society probably was another big help in the when I was interviewed by the president of UOP. He said to me, have you ever managed a budget? And I said, well, yeah, I manage my own research budget, and I've got about 14 or 15 people. But I said, I am chairman of the board of directors of the American Chemical Society, and I said, the board is the management for the society, and I said, we manage a budget of about $160 million a year. And I think that probably did make a difference. I suspect that probably reassured him that you really could look at the budget and the money and decide how it should be spent and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
You mentioned about innovations, particularly with computer access you made at UOP when you went there. Do you recall any particular initiatives you made while you were an ACS governor?
Yeah, there was one in particular. Bryce Crawford and I together, I think, actually caused Chemical Abstracts to move towards computerized publications. I mean, the whole issue of moving to computer program to computer applications, online applications, and we finally set for them a target that they should have 50% of their income should come from that sort of activity in a certain period of time. And I think had we not done that, and both of us, he and I had from one time or another had both been chairman of the publications committee to whom CAS in those days still reported, and on the board, and it was clear that if CAS did not move in that direction, they were not going to survive. And my guess is that, you know, of all of the changes that, I mean, the real initiatives and what I consider to be changes that made a difference, I think modern CAS is an outcome of that. I'm not saying we did all of it by any stretch of the imagination, but...
Set it in motion.
Exactly. Right. And the other one that we did was that I helped them do was the interaction in the international environment. We actually put together that joint agreement with the British, and then we did the joint agreement with the Germans, and ultimately the joint agreement with the Japanese. And those were initiatives that we sort of put in place. And again, I think CAS would not be where it is today had it not done those sorts of joint initiatives.
Now it's, in effect, almost an autonomous operation
right.
In terms of separation from reporting to the publication committee.
Correct.
And so forth.
Yeah, well, actually now they've gone even further than that. The new outside governance board now includes publications as well as CAS. In other words, they put them back together again, which
yeah.
I find fascinating. But they have essentially removed the control of them, certainly the business control, now to this outside autonomous group. The board has not all that much clout with
them. Had that type of organization been in place when you were in the governance structure, it would have been improbable that you and Bryce Crawford could have
mm-hmm.
made the initiative and the goal setting that you did. Do you see that as an impairment to the future of CAS?
That's true, except that had you had a board like that in place, they probably would have seen it as well, because it truly was a business issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guess is that they would have seen it, frankly, long before the academicians that sat on the publications committee would have seen it. So I think probably it would not have mattered. I think it would have gotten moved because of that. Now, the real problem today is that CAS, in some ways, in my view, and the publications program too, is at the same sort of crossroads they were back in the early 80s, in the sense that in those days the whole business was you were either going to get that process computerized, you know, the process of creating the CAS and so forth, or you just weren't going to be able to do it, you just couldn't afford it. Today, the issue now that's on the table is what is going to be the role of agents and like CAS in what is going to become online publications. And the issue there is going to have, I think, there's two major issues, and people like the American Chemical Society should focus on them. One of those is, in this age of being able to put up anything you want on the Internet, people are putting up their preprints and all that kind of stuff right now. And the question is, what does it mean to get it published in a journal? And how long will you be able to get people to publish in journals? My guess is they wouldn't publish there today, except for the fact that universities only recognize peer-reviewed journal articles as promotional material. But at some point that'll crack as well. And so you won't have there'll be no driver, actually. And so the question is, what is the scientific dissemination going to look like in the next 10 years. And the two big questions that affect the American Chemical Society, both from the journal side and from CAS side, is number one, how do you assess quality? How do you decide whether a paper is worthy of archiving or not? And the second is how do you archive? And who does it? And I think those are the questions that nobody knows how that's going to come out at the moment, nor has anybody really put enough thought and effort into that.
And also the issue of what reliability to ascribe to the paper
if it has not been reviewed
by experts in the field.
Well, and for example, what should you bother to archive it if it has not? That's exactly right. I mean, how do you decide whether this is a paper worthy of an archival spot or not? And you want to do, I mean, it's essential that we work that out, because you sure don't want people reinventing the wheel either. So, but I think this is an area that's just not even, it's not really even being addressed in what I consider to be any kind of a holistic way today. Within 10 years, it'll have to be addressed, because the internet is here. It's not going to go away. And the rapidity at which you can disseminate information is so great that not to have the ability to, both do the quality control and decide on how you're going to go about that, I think it just has to be done. I don't see much of anybody doing much with it, frankly.
Peer review doesn't guarantee that the paper is reliable, but it's the only way we have.
Well, but between peer review and the editor's oversight, things like that, you certainly have a quality there that you don't have if you just dump it on the internet when you want. And there's just nobody, and I think that committee, that oversight board that has the oversight responsibility for ACS journals and CAS is the right vehicle to begin to worry about these issues, okay? Because we're the biggest scientific publisher of anybody, and and the other question is, so long as we had hard copy and all that, we know how to get paid. And the question that's going to be, that's on the table on these two issues we're talking about now, is who's going to pay for that quality control, and who's going to pay to do the archives? And that's not clear at the moment, because even university folks are beginning to be somewhat upset by not being paid to review. And you keep hearing rumblings in the background about and people being aggravated that you get all this free reviewing, and then you charge me back for the journal more than I think I should pay, and so there's always that bit of rumbling out there. So I don't know how that's going to come out. I don't think people have really addressed it yet.
Tell me something about your work on the National Science Board and your association with the National Science Foundation.
Well, I was, I was appointed to the National Science Board in 1980 by Jimmy Carter. And I suspect that a lot of the legwork to get me appointed was really done by Joe Reynolds. Joe had been on the National Science Board, and his term was essentially over. And I'm sure that he and some of the people at LSU ran all of the traps, to political traps, to get that appointment made. So I came on in 1980, and it was kind of an interesting time, because that was the days of the Golden Fleece Award, and it turned out one of the very first meetings I ever attended, Atkinson was the director at NSF, and we were discussing this whole business about the Golden Fleece Award, and finally we tried to explain to him that what he needed to do was to clean up the titles, so that people didn't get these silly titles that then let them run all over the world with. So that was sort of my introduction to the National Science Board. I very much enjoyed working with the National Science Board. I think NSF is certainly one of the best government agencies even today, even though it's getting a little old and has some of the problems of aged government institutions. But it still does a very good job. Its overhead's about 5%. In other words, every dollar it gets, about 95 cents goes outside. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. Compared to other agencies we could talk about, that's excellent. And I think that over time it has really done what it should have done. It's not to say that you know, that every program has been the right one or any of those things. It never is. But and they've always managed to come up with somebody to truly provide some oomph for it at the right time. Eric Block really sort of revitalized the agency. You know, he really moved it forward, and he got them to do some new things. He got them to create the engineering centers. He got them to create the science centers. And although the academic community, for the most part, wasn't in favor of those, because they didn't want, they wanted only peer-reviewed single grantee awards. But what they don't realize is that when you were there and you looked at the politics, by getting the fact that he could sell those centers, what the people don't realize is they got more money for single applicant awards at the same time. In other words, he used those as levers to create excitement in the Congress to get the entire budget of NSF improved. And I think without them, you wouldn't have seen the increases that you've seen in the last few years.
How long were you on the National Science Board?
Till 1991. I was reappointed in 1996 by President Reagan.
86,
right, by President Reagan. And that was kind of an interesting one, because having been appointed by Carter, you wouldn't expect to get reappointed by Reagan. But some of my Republican friends weighed in, and Eric, I think, made a big pitch as well. And so we...